Zeit 9.
Look, brother, says I, this is a great political affair, as you guessed. I cannot tell thee, and I cannot leave India. Then thou art dead, says he cheerfully. Kali's hand will be on thee through these messengers. And he pointed at the dead thug. Hold on, says I, sweating. They're looking for Colonel Flashman. But if Colonel Flashman becomes, say, a Kayakin pony peddler, or an Abizai who has done his time in the guides or lancers, how will they find him then? I've done it before, remember. Damn it, I speak Pashto as well as you do, and Urdu even better. Wasn't I an agent with Sikandar Saab? All I need is a safe place for a season to lie up and sniff the wind before... And I started lying recklessly for effect, before I steal out again, having made my plans to break this one-eyed fakir and his rabble of stranglers and loose-wallers. Do you see? Inshallah, cries he, grinning all over his evil face. It is the great game, to lie low in disguise, and watch and listen and wait, and conspire with the other political sahibs of the Sarkar until the time is ripe, and then go against these evil subverters in a secret razia. And when that time comes, I may share the sport, and halal these Hindu and foreign swine with my lads. Thou wouldst not forget thy old friend, then? He grabbed my hand, the bloodthirsty devil. Thou'lt send me word, surely, when the knives are out. Thy brother, Ilderim? You'll wait a long time for it, my lad, thinks I. Give me a good disguise and a pony, and you'll not see me again. Not until everything is safely blown over and some other idiot has disposed of Ignatieff and his bravos. That's when I'd emerge, with a good yarn to spin to Calcutta and Pam about how I'd gone after him secretly, and damn it, I'd missed the blight of bad luck. That would serve and sound sufficiently mysterious and convincing, but for the moment my urgent need was a disguise and a hiding place at a safe distance. Some jungly or desert spot might be best. I'd lived rough that way before, and, as I'd told Ilderim, I could pass as a frontiersman or Afghan with any of them. When there are rusky throats to be cut, you'll be the first to know, I assured him, and he embraced me, chuckling and swearing I was the best of brothers. The matter of disguise reminded me that I was still stark naked and shivering. I told him I wanted a kit exactly like that of his sowars, and he swore I'd have it, and a pony, too. And you may tell Skeen Sahib from me, says I, that the time has come, and that he can start feeling sorry for the Ruskies. He'll understand. For I wasn't going back to the cantonment. I wanted to ride out tonight, wherever I was going. Tell him of the one-eyed fakir, that the thugs are abroad again, and the axles are getting hot. You may say I've had a brush with the enemy already, but you needn't tell him what else I was doing tonight. I winked at him. Understand? Oh, aye, and if he has inquiries after me from the Rani of Jhansi, he may say I have been called away and present my apologies. The Rani, says he, and his eyes strayed towards the pavilion. Aye, he coughed and grinned. That was some rich lady's palanquin I saw tonight, and many servants. Perchance was it? A Gilzai and a grandmother for scandal, I quoted. Mind your own damn business. And now, be a good lad, and get me that outfit and pony. He summoned one of his rascals, and asked if the tortured thug was dead yet. Nay, but he has no more to tell, says the other. For he said nothing when I... You wouldn't wish to know what he said next. Shall I pass him some of his own tobacco? He added. Aye, says Ilderim. And tell Rafik Tamwar I want all his clothes and his knife and his horse. Go thou. For answer, the sowar nodded, took out his Khyber knife, and stepped back under the trees to where his companions were guarding the prisoner, or what was left of him. I heard him address the brute. Even at that time and place, it was an extraordinary enough exchange to fix itself in my mind. One of the most astonishing things I ever heard, even in India. It is over, deceiver, says he. Here is the knife, in the throat or the heart. Choose. The thug's reply was hoarse with agony.
In the heart, then. Quickly.
You're sure? As you wish?
No, wait,
gasps the thug.
"Put the point behind my ear, so thrust hard. Thus I will bleed less and go undisfigured. Now."
There was a pause, and then the sour's voice says, "He was right. He bleeds hardly at all. Trust a deceiver to know." A few moments later, and Rafik Tamwar appeared, grumbling, in a rag of loincloth, with his clothes over his arm, and leading a neat little pony. I told Ilderim that Skeen Sahib must see his kit replaced, and he could have my own Pegu pony, at which the good Tamwar grinned through his beard, and said he would willingly make such an exchange every day. I slipped into his shirt and cavalry breeches, drew on the soft boots, donned his hairy poshteen, stuck the Khyber cleaver in my sash, and was winding the puggaree round my head and wishing I had a revolver as well, when Ilderim says thoughtfully, "Where wilt thou go, Flashman? Have ye an eyrie to wait in, where no enemy can find thee?" I confessed I hadn't, and asked if he had any suggestions, at which he frowned thoughtfully, and then smiled, and then roared with laughter, and rolled on his back, and then stood up, peering and grinning at me. "Some juice for thy skin," says he. "Aye, and when thy beard has grown, thou'll be a rare Peshawar ruffler. So ye swagger enough and curl thy hair round thy finger and spit from the back of thy throat?" "I know all about that," says I impatiently. "Where do you suggest I do all these things?"
"In the last place any ill-willer would ever look for a British colonel, sahib," says he, chortling. "Look now. Wouldst thou live easy for a spell, and eat full, and grow fat, what time thou art preparing to play the game against these enemies of the Raj?"
"Aye, and get well paid for it, 24 rupees a month, and field allowance also." He slapped his hands together at my astonishment. "Why not join the Sarkar's army? What a recruit for the native cavalry! Why, given a month, they'll make thee a Dafadar." He stuck his tongue in his cheek. "Maybe a Risaldar in time, who knows?"
"Are you mad?" says I. "Me enlist as a sower? And how the devil do you expect me to get away with that?"
"What hinders? Thou hast passed in Kabul Bazaar before today, and along the Kandahar road. Stain thy face, as I said, and grow thy beard, and thou'lt be the properest Sarkar's bargain in India. Does it not meet thy need, and will it not place thee close to affairs? Within reach of thine own folk, and ready to move at a finger-snap?"
It was ridiculous. And yet the more I thought of it, the more obvious it was. How long did I want to hide? A month? 2 or 3, perhaps. I would have to live, and for the life of me I couldn't think of a more discreet and comfortable hiding place than the ranks of a native cavalry regiment. I had all the qualifications and experience, if I was careful. But I'd have to be that, whatever I did. I stood considering, while Ilderim urged me, full of enthusiasm. "See now! There is my mother's cousin, Ghulam Beg, who was Malik in one of my father's villages, and is now Wordy Major in the 3rd Cavalry at Meerut Garrison. If thou goest to him and say Ilderim sent thee, will he not be glad of such a fine, sturdy trooper? He may touch the hilt and eat the salt, and belike he'll forget the deposit for my sake." "Let me see now," says this mad rascal, chuckling as he warmed to his work. "Thou art a Yusufzai Pathan of the Peshawar Valley. No, no, better still, we'll have the Ahazanzai of the Black Mountain. They are strange folk, touched and given to wild fits, so much may be excused thee. Oh, it is rare. Thou art Makaram Khan, late of the Peshawar police, and so familiar with the ways of the sahibs. Thou hast skirmished along the line, too. Never fear, there was a Makaram Khan, until I shot him on my last furlough. He will give thee a greeting from hell, for he was a stout rider in his time. Careless, though, or he'd have watched the rocks as he rode. Well, Makaram," says he, grinning like a wolf in the gloom, "wilt thou carry a lance for the Sarkar?"
I'd been determining, even as he talked. I was in the greatest fix, and there was no other choice. If I'd known what it would lead to, I'd have damned Ilderim's notion to his teeth, but it seemed inspired at the time. "Bind thy puggaree round thy jaw at night, lest thou babble in English in thy sleep," says he at parting. "Be sullen, and speak little, and be a good soldier, blood brother, for the credit of Ilderim Khan." He laughed and slapped my saddle as we shook hands in the dark under the trees. "When thou comest this way again, go to Bull Temple, beyond the Jokhan Bar. I will have a man waiting for an hour at sunrise and sunset. Salam, Sowa, cries he, and saluted, and I dug my heels into my pony and cantered off into the dawn, still like a man in a wild dream. You might think it impossible for a white man to pass himself off as a native soldier in John Company's army, and indeed I doubt if anyone else has ever done it. But when you've been called on to play as many parts as I have, it's a bagatelle. Why, I've been a Danish prince, a Texas slave dealer, an Arab sheikh, a Cheyenne dog soldier, and a Yankee Navy lieutenant in my time, among other things. And none of them was as hard to sustain as my lifetime's impersonation of a British officer and gentleman. The truth is, we all live under false pretenses much of the time. You just have to put on a bold front and brazen it through. I'll admit my gift of languages has been my greatest asset, and I suppose I'm a pretty fair actor. Anyway, I'd carried off the role of an Asian Afghan nigger often enough, and before I was more than a day's ride on the way to Meerut, I was thoroughly back in the part, singing Kabuli bazaar songs through my nose, sneering sideways at anyone I passed, and answering greetings with a grunt or a snarl. I had to keep my chin and mouth covered for the first 3 days, until my beard had sprouted to a disreputable stubble. Apart from that, I needed no disguise, for I was dark and dirty-looking enough to start with. By the time I struck the Grand Trunk, my own mother wouldn't have recognized the big, hairy border ruffian, jogging along so raffishly with his boots out of his stirrups, and his lovelock curling out under his puggaree. On the seventh day, when I cursed and shoved my pony through the crowded streets of Meerut City, spurning the rabble aside as a good Hasan-sai should, I was even thinking in Pushtu. And if you'd offered me a 7-course dinner at the Café Royal, I'd have turned it down for mutton and rice stew with boiled dates to follow. My only anxiety was Ilderim's cousin, Ghulam Beg, whom I had to seek out in the native cavalry lines beyond the city. He would be sure to run a sharp eye over a new recruit, and if he spotted anything queer about me, I'd have a hard job keeping up the imposture. Indeed, at the last minute my nerves slackened a little, and I rode about for a couple of hours before I plucked up the courage to go and see him. I rode on past the native infantry lines, and over the Nullah Bridge up to the Mall in the British town. It was while I was sitting my pony brooding under the trees that a dog-cart with 2 English children and their mother went by, and one of the brats squealed with excitement and said I looked just like Ali Baba and the 40 Thieves. That cheered me up, for some reason. Anyway, I had to have a place to eat and sleep while I shirked my duty, so I finally presented myself at the headquarters of the 3rd Native Light Cavalry and demanded to see the wordy major. I needn't have worried. Ghulam Beg was a stout, white-whiskered old cove with silver-rimmed spectacles on the end of his nose, and when I announced that Ilderim Khan of Moghala was my sponsor, he was all over me. Hasan-sai was I, and later the police. That was good. I had the look of an able man. Yes, doubtless the colonel's sahib would look favourably on such a fine, upstanding recruit. I had seen no military service, though. He looked at me quizzically, and I tried to slouch a bit more. "Not in the guides, perhaps," says he, with his head on one side. "Or the Kutch cavalry? No? Then doubtless it is by chance that you stand the regulation 3 paces from my table and clench your hand with the thumb forward, and that the pony I see out yonder is girthed and bridled like one of ours." He chuckled playfully. "A man's past is his own affair, Makaram Khan. What should it profit us to pry and discover that a new recruit had once quit the Sarkar's service over some small matter of feud or bloodletting, eh? You come from Ilderim. It is enough. Be ready to see the Colonel Sahib at noon." He'd spotted me for an old soldier, you see, which was all to the good. Having detected me in a small deception, it never occurred to him to look for a large one. And he must have passed on his conclusion to the colonel, for when I made my salaam to that worthy officer on the orderly room veranda, he looked me up and down and says to the worthy major in English, "Shouldn't wonder if you weren't right, Ghulam Beg. He's heard Boots and Saddles before, that's plain. Probably got bored with garrison work and slipped off one night with 6 rifles on his back. And now, having cut the wrong throat or lifted the wrong herd, he's come well south to avoid retribution.
He sat back, fingering the big white moustache which covered most of his crimson face.
"Ugly-looking devil, ain't he, though? Hassan Sai of the Black Mountain, eh? Yes, that's what I'd have thought. Very good." He frowned at me, and then said, very carefully, "Company Cavalry Apka Mangtar,"
which abomination of bad Urdu I took to mean, did I want to join the company cavalry? So I showed my teeth and says, "An, Sahib," and thought I might as well act out my part by betraying some more military knowledge. I ducked my head and leaned over and offered him the hilt of my sheathed Khyber knife, at which he burst out laughing and touched it, saying that Ghulam Beg was undoubtedly right, and I wasn't half knowledgeable for a chap who pretended never to have been in the army before. He gave instructions for me to be sworn in, and I took the oath on the sabre blade, ate a pinch of salt, and was informed that I was now a skirmisher of the 3rd Native Light Cavalry, that my dafadar was Kudrat Ali, that I would be paid 1 rupee a day with a quarter and a dying allowance, and that since I had brought my own horse, I would be excused the customary recruit deposit. Also that if I was half as much a soldier as the colonel suspected, and kept my hands off other people's throats and property, I might expect promotion in due course. Thereafter I was issued with a new puggari, half-boots and pyjama breeches, a new and very smart silver-grey uniform coat, a regulation sabre, a belt and a bandolier, and a tangle of saddlery which was old and stiff enough to have been used at Waterloo, and probably had, and informed by a beetle-chewing havildar that if I didn't have it reduced to gleaming suppleness by next morning, I had best look out. Finally he took me to the armoury, and I was shown, mark this well, a new rifled Enfield musket, serial number 4413, some things a soldier never forgets, which I was informed was mine henceforth, and more precious than my own mangy carcass. Without thinking, I picked it up and tested the action, as I'd done a score of times at Woolwich, and the Goanese storewaller gaped.
"Who taught you that?" says he. "And who bade you handle it, jangly pig? It is for you to see. You touch it only when it is issued on parade."
And he snatched it back from me. I thought another touch of character would do no harm, so I waited till he'd waddled away to replace it on the rack, and then whipped out my Khyber knife and let it fly, intending to plant it in the wall a foot or so away from him. My aim was off, though. The knife embedded itself in the wall all right, but it nicked his arm in passing, and he squealed and rolled on the floor, clutching at his blood-smeared sleeve.
"Bring the knife back!" I snarled,
baring my fangs at him, and when he'd scrambled up, grey-faced and terrified, and returned it, I touched the point on his chest and says,
"Call Makaram Khan a pig just once more, son of an owl, and I will carry thine eyes and genitals on this point as kebabs."
Then I made him lick the blood off the blade, spat in his face, and respectfully asked the Havildar what I should do next. He, being a Mussulman, was all for me, and, grinning, said that I should make a fair recruit. He told my dafadar, Kudrat Ali, about the incident, and presently the word went round the big, airy barrack room that Makaram Khan was a genuine saddle and lance man from up yonder, who would strike first and inquire after. Doubtless a border lifter and a feud-carrier, but a man who knew how to treat Hindu insolence, and therefore to be properly respected. So there I was. Colonel Harry Paget Flashman, late of the 11th Hussars, 17th Lancers, and the Staff, former aide to the Commander-in-Chief, and now acting sowar and rear file in the skirmishing squadron, 3rd Cavalry, Bengal Army. And if you think it was a mad-brained train of circumstance that had taken me there, well, so did I. But once I'd got over the unreality of it all and stopped imagining that everyone was going to see through my disguise, I settled in comfortably enough. It was an eerie feeling, though, at first, to squat on my bunk against the wall with my puggari off, combing my hair or oiling my light harness, and look round that room at the brown, half-naked figures, laughing and chattering, of all the things that soldiers talk about, women and officers and barrack gossip and women and rations and women, but in a foreign tongue which, although I spoke it perfectly and even with a genuine frontier accent, was still not my own. While I'd been by myself, as I say, I'd even been thinking in Pashto, but here I had to hold on tight and remember what I was meant to be. For one thing, I wasn't used to being addressed in familiar terms by native soldiers, much less ordered about by an officious Nike, who'd normally have leapt to attention if I'd so much as looked in his direction. When the man who bunked next to me, Pierre Ali, a jolly rascal of a Baluk, tapped my shoulder in suggesting that we might visit the bazaar that first evening, I absolutely stared at him and just managed to bite back that "damn your impudence" that sprang to my tongue. It wasn't easy for a while, quite apart from remembering obeisances at the prescribed times and making a show at cooking my own dinner at the Chula. There were a thousand tiny details to beware of. I must remember not to cross my legs when sitting, or blow my nose like a European, or say "mm" if someone said something I couldn't catch, or use the wrong hand, or clear my throat in the discreet British fashion, or do any of the things that would have looked damned odd in an Afghan frontiersman. Of course, I made mistakes. Once or twice I was just plain ignorant of things that I should have known, like how to chew a majun when Pierre Ali offered me one. You have to spit into your hand from time to time, or you'll end up poisoned. Or how to cut a sheep tail for curry, or even how to sharpen my knife in the approved fashion. When I blundered, and anyone noticed, I found the best way was to stare them down and growl sullenly. But more often than not, my danger lay in betraying knowledge which Makaram Khan simply wouldn't have had. For example, when Kudrat Ali was giving us sword exercise, I found myself once falling into the rest position of a German Schlager fencer. Not that anyone in India was likely to recognize that. And again, daydreaming about fagging days at rugby while cleaning my boots one evening, I found myself humming Widdecombe Fair, fortunately under my breath. My worst blunder, though, was when I was walking near a spot where the British officers were playing cricket, and the ball came skipping towards me. Without so much as thinking, I snapped it up and was looking to throw down the wicket, when I remembered, and threw it back as clumsily as I could. One or two of them stared, though, and I heard someone say that big nigger was a deuced smart field. That rattled me, and I trod even more carefully than before. My best plan, I soon discovered, was to do and say as little as possible, and act the surly, reserved hillman who walked by himself and whom it was safest not to disturb. The fact that I was by way of being a protégé of the worthy majors and a Hasanzai, and therefore supposedly eccentric, led to my being treated with a certain deference. My imposing size and formidable looks did the rest, and I was left pretty much alone. Once or twice I walked out with Pierre Ali to lounge in the old market and ogle the bints, or dally with them in the boutique doorways, but he found my grunts a poor return for his own cheery prattle, and abandoned me to my own devices. It wasn't, as you can guess, the liveliest life for me at first, but I only had to think of the alternative to resign myself to it for the present. It was easy enough soldiering, and I quickly won golden opinions from my Naik and Jamadar for the speed and intelligence with which I appeared to learn my duties. At first it was a novelty, drilling, working, eating, and sleeping with 30 Indian troopers, rather like being on the other side of the bars of a monkey zoo. But when you're closed into a world whose four corners are the barrack room, the chula, the stables, and the Maidan, it can become maddening to have to endure the society of an inferior and foreign race with whom you've no more in common than if they were Russian mujiks or Irish bog-trotters. What makes it 10 times worse is the outcast feeling that comes of knowing that within a mile or two your own kind are enjoying all the home comforts, damn 'em. Drinking burra pegs, smoking decent cigars, flirting and ramming with white women, and eating ices for dessert. I was no longer so enamoured of mutton pilau in ghee, you gather. Within a fortnight I'd have given anything to join an English conversation again, instead of listening to Pierre Ali giggling about how he'd bullocked the headman's wife on his last leave, or the endless details of Sita Gopal's uncle's lawsuit, or Ram Mangal's reviling of the Havildar, or Gobinda Dal's whining about how he and his brothers, being soldiers, had lost much of the petty local influence they'd formerly enjoyed in their Oud village, now that the Sirkar had taken over. When it got too bad, I would loaf up to the Mall and gape at the memsahibs in their big hats and parasols driving by, and watch the officers cantering past, flicking their crops as I clumped my big boots and saluted, or squat near the church to listen to them singing Greenland's Icy Mountains of a Sunday evening. Damn it, I missed my own folk then, far worse than if they'd been 100 miles away. I missed Lakshmi Bai, too. Odd, ain't it? But I think what riled me most was the knowledge that if she'd seen me as I now was, well, she wouldn't even have noticed me. However, it had to be stuck out. I just had to think of Ignatieff. So I would trudge back to barracks and lie glowering while the sowars chattered. It had this value. I learned more about Indian soldiers in 3 weeks than I'd have done in a lifetime's ordinary service. You'll think I'm being clever afterwards, but I soon realized that all wasn't as well with them as I'd have thought at first sight. They were northern Muslims, mostly, with a sprinkling of high-caste Oud Hindus. The practice of separating the races in different companies or troops hadn't come in then. Good soldiers, too. The Third had distinguished itself in the last Sikh war, and a few had frontier service. But they weren't happy. Smart as you'd wish on parade. But in the evening they would sit about and croak like hell. At first I thought it was just the usual military sore-headedness. But it wasn't. At first, all I heard was vague allusions, which I didn't inquire about for fear of betraying a suspicious ignorance. They talked a good deal about one of the padres in the garrison, Reynolds Saab, and how Colonel Carmichael Smith, that was the Third's commander, Carmichael Smith, ought to keep him off the post, and there was a fairly general repeated croak about polluted flour and the Enlistment Act. But I didn't pay much heed until one night, I remember, an Oud Sowar came back from the bazaar in a tremendous taking. I don't even remember his name, but what had happened was that he'd been taking part in a wrestling match with some local worthy, and before he'd got his shirt back on afterwards, some British troopers from the Dragoon Guards who were there at the time had playfully snapped the sacred cord which he wore over his shoulder next to the skin, as his kind of Hindus did.
"Banchuts! Scum!"
He was actually weeping with rage.
"It is defiled! I am unclean!"
And for all that his mates tried to cheer him up, saying he could get a new one, blessed by a holy man, he went on raving. They take these things very seriously, you know, like Jews and Muslims with pork. If it seems foolish to you, you may compare it with how you'd feel if a nigger pissed in the font at your own church.
"I shall go to the colonel, Sahib," says he finally.
And one of the Hindus, Gobinda Dal, sneered,
"Why should he care? The man who will defile our Atta will not rebuke an English soldier for this."
"What's all this about the Atta?" says I to Pir Ali, and he shrugged.
"The Hindus say that the Sahibs are grinding cow bones into the sepoy's flour to break their caste. For me they can break any Hindu's stupid caste and welcome."
"Why should they do that?" says I. And Sita Gopal, who overheard, spat and says,
"Where have you lived, Hazansai? The Sirkar will break every man's caste, aye, and what passes for caste, even among you Muslims. There are pig bones in the Atta, too, in case you don't know it. Naik Shir Afzul in the second troop told me. Did he not see them ground at the Sahib's factory at Cawnpore?" "Wind from a monkey's backside," says I. "What would it profit the Sahibs to pollute your food? Since when do they hate their soldiers?"
To my astonishment, about half a dozen of them scoffed aloud at this.
"Listen to the Black Mountain Munshi. The Sahibs love their soldiers, and so the Gora cavalry broke Lal's string for him tonight. Have you never heard of the dum-dum sweeper, Makaram Khan?"
And so on. Ram Mangal, who was the noisiest croaker of them all, spat out,
"It is of a piece with the Padre Sahib's talk, and the new regulation that will send men across the Kala Pani. They will break our caste to make us Christians. Do they not know this, even where you come from, Hillman? Why, it is the talk of the army."
I growled that I didn't put any faith in latrine gossip, especially if the latrine was a Hindu one, and at this one of the older men, Sardul something or other, shook his head and says gravely,
"It was no latrine rumour, Makaram Khan, that came out of Dum Dum Arsenal."
And for the first time I heard the astonishing tale that was, I discovered, accepted as gospel by every sepoy in the Bengal army, of the sweeper at Dum Dum who'd asked a caste sepoy for a drink from his dish, and, on being refused, had told the sepoy that he needn't be so damn particular because the Sahibs were going to do away with caste by defiling every soldier in the army by greasing their cartridges with cow and pig fat.
"This thing is known," says old Sardul positively, and he was the kind of old soldier that men listened to.
30 years' service, Aliwal medal, and clean conduct sheet, damn your eyes.
Is not the new Enfield musket in the armory? Are not the new greased cartridges being prepared? How can any man keep his religion?
They say that at Benares, the Jaiwans have been permitted to grease their own loads, says Pier Ali, but they hooted him down.
They say, cries Ram Mangal, it is like the tale they put about that all the grease was mutton fat. If that were so, where is the need for anyone to make his own grease? It is a lie, just as the Enlistment Act is a lie, when they said it was a provision only, and that no one would be asked to do foreign service. Ask the 19th at Berhampore, where their officers told them they must serve in Burma if they refused the cartridge when it was issued.
Aye, but they will refuse. Then we'll see.
He waved his hands in passion.
The polluted atta is another link in the chain, like the preaching of that owl Reynolds Saab with his Jesus talk, which Carmichael his meat permits to our offence. He wants to put us to shame.
It is true enough, says old Sardul sadly.
Yet I would not believe it if such a Saab as my old Colonel MacGregor, did he not take a bullet meant for me at Kandahar, were to look me in my eye and say it was false. The pity is that Carmichael Ismeet is not such a Saab. There is none such nowadays, says he, with morbid satisfaction, and the army is but a poor ruin of what it was. You do not know today what officers wear. If you had seen Sail Saib, or Larynx Saib, or Cotton Saib, you would have seen men.
Since he'd served in Afghanistan, I'd hoped he would mention Iflasman Saib, but he didn't, the croaking old bastard.
They would have died before they would have put dishonour on their sepoys. Their children, they used to call us, and we would have followed them to hell. But now, he wagged his head again, these are Kutch Saibs, not Pukka Saibs, and the English common soldiers are no better. Why, in my young day, an English trooper would call me brother, give me his hand, offer me his water bottle, not realizing that I could not take it, you understand. And now these common men spit on us, call us monkeys and hubshis, and break Lal's string.
Most of their talk was just patent rubbish, of course, and I'd no doubt it was the work of agitators, spreading disaffection with their nonsense about greased cartridges and polluted food. I almost said so, but decided it would be unwise to draw attention to myself. And anyway, it wasn't such a burning topic of conversation most of the time that one could take it seriously. I knew they put tremendous store by their religion, the Hindus especially, and I suppose that whenever an incident like Lal's string stirred them up, all the old grievances came out and were soon forgotten. But I'll confess that what Sardul had said about the British officers and troops reminded me of John Nicholson's misgivings. I'd hardly seen a British officer on parade since my enlistment. They seemed content to leave their troops to the Jamadars and NCOs, Addiscombe tribe, of course, and there was no question the British rankers in the Meerut garrison were a poorer type, say, than the 44th whom I'd known in the old Afghan days, or Campbell's Highlanders. I got first-hand evidence of this a day or two later, when I accidentally jostled a dragoon in the bazaar, and the brute turned straight round and lashed out with his boot.
"Out the way, you black bastard," says he. "Think you can shove a Saib around, Banshut?"
And he would have taken a swipe at me with his fist, too, but I just put my hand on my knife-hilt and glared at him. It wouldn't have been prudent to do more.
"Christ!" says he,
and took to his heels until he got to the end of the street, where he snatched up a stone and flung it at me. It smashed a plate on a booth nearby, and then made off. "I'll remember you, my lad," thinks I, "and the day'll come when I'll have you triced up and flogged to ribbons." And I did, as good luck had it. I've never been so wild that the scum of a Whitechapel gutter should take his boot to me. I'll be honest and say that if I'd seen him do it to a native 2 months earlier, I wouldn't have minded a bit, and still wouldn't much. It's a nigger's lot to be kicked. But it ain't mine, and I can't tell you how I felt afterwards, filthy in a way, because I hadn't been able to pay the swine back. That's by the way. The point is that old Sardul was right. There wasn't the respect for Jawans among the British that there had been in my young day. We probably lashed and kicked niggers just as much, I know I did, but there was a higher regard for the sepoys, at least, on the whole. I doubt if any commander in the old days would have done what Carmichael Smith did in the way of preaching parades, either. I hadn't believed it in the barrack gossip, but sure enough, the next Sunday, this coffin-faced Anglican fakir, the Reverend Reynolds, had a muster on the Maidan, and we had to listen to him expounding the parable of the prodigal son, if you please. He did it through a brazen-lunged Resaldar who interpreted for him, and you never heard the like. Reynolds lined it out in English, from the Bible, and the Resaldar stood there with his staff under his arm at attention, with his whiskers bristling, bawling his own translation. "There was a zamindar with two sons. He was a mad zamindar, for while he yet lived, he gave to the younger his portion of the inheritance. Doubtless he raised it from a moneylender. And the younger spent it all whoring in a bazaar and drinking sherab. And when his money was gone, he returned home, and his father ran to meet him, for he was pleased. God alone knows why. And in his foolishness, the father slew his only cow. He was evidently not a Hindu, and they feasted on it. And the older son, who had been dutiful and stayed at home, was jealous. I cannot tell for what reason, unless the cow was to have been part of his inheritance. But his father, who did not like him, rebuked the older son. This story was told by Jesus the Jew. And if you believe it, you will not go to paradise, but instead will sit on the right-hand side of the English Lord God Sahib, who lives in Calcutta. And there you will play musical instruments by order of the Sarkar. Parade! Dismiss!"
I don't know when I've been more embarrassed on behalf of my church and country. I'm as religious as the next man, which is to say I'll keep in with a local parson for form's sake and read the lessons on feast days because my tenants expect it, but I've never been fool enough to confuse religion with belief in God. That's where so many clergymen, like the unspeakable Reynolds, go wrong, and it makes them arrogant and totally blind to the harm they may be doing. This idiot was so drunk with testaments that he couldn't conceive how ill-mannered and offensive he was making himself look. I suppose he thought of high-caste Hindus as being like willful children or drunken costermongers, perverse and misguided, but ripe for salvation if he just pointed them the way. He stood there, with his unctuous fat face and piggy eyes, blessing us soapily, while the Muslims, being worldly in their worship, tried not to laugh, and the Hindus fairly seethed. I'd have found it amusing enough, I dare say, if I hadn't been irritated by the thought that these irresponsible Christian zealots were only making things harder for the army and company who had important work to do. It was all so foolish and unnecessary. The heathen creeds, for all their nonsensical mumbo-jumbo, were as good as any for keeping the rabble in order, and what else is religion for? In any event, this misguided attempt to cure Hindu souls took place not just at Meerut, but elsewhere, according to the religious intoxication of the local commanders, and in my opinion was the most important cause of the mischief that followed. I didn't appreciate this at the time, and couldn't have done anything if I had. Besides, I had more important matters to engage my attention. A few days after that parade, there was a gymkhana on the Maidan, and I rode for the skirmishers in the Nezabazi. Apart from languages and fornication, horsemanship is my only accomplishment, and I've been well grounded in tent-pegging by the late Mohammed Iqbal, so it was no surprise that I took the greatest number of pegs, and would have got even more if I'd had a pony that I knew, and my lance hadn't snapped in a touch-peg on the last round. It was enough to take the cup, though, and old bloody Bill Hewitt, the garrison commander, slipped the handle over my broken lance point in front of the marquee, where all the top numbers of Meerut society were sitting applauding politely, the ladies in their crinolines and the men behind their chairs.
"Shabash, Soa," says bloody Bill. "Where did you learn to manage a lance?"
"Peshawar Valley, Hussar," says I.
"Company cavalry," says he,
and I said, "No, Peshawar police."
"Didn't know they were lancers," said he.
And Carmichael Smith, who was on hand, laughed and said to Hewitt in English, "No more they are, sir. It's a rather delicate matter, I suspect. This bird here pretends he's never served the Sarkar before, but he's got guide written all over him. Shouldn't wonder if he wasn't Risaldar, Havildar at least.
but we don't ask embarrassing questions, what? He's a damn good recruit, anyway.
Ah, says Hewitt, grinning. He was a fat, kindly old buffer. Nuff said, then.
And I was in the act of saluting when a little puff of wind sprang up, scattering the papers which were on the table behind him, and blowing them under the pony's hooves. Like a good little toady, I slipped out of the saddle and gathered them up, and without thinking set them on the table and put the inkpot on top of them to hold them steady. A simple, ordinary thing. But I heard an exclamation, and looked up to see Duff Mason, one of the infantry colonels, staring at me in surprise.
I just salaamed and saluted and was back in my saddle in a second, while they called up the next man for his prize.
But as I wheeled my pony away, I saw that Mason was looking after me with a puzzled smile on his face, and saying something to the officer next to him.
"Hello," thinks I. "Has he spotted something?"
But I couldn't think I'd done anything to give myself away, until next morning, when the Resaldar called me out of the ranks and told me to report to Mason's office in the British lines forthwith.
I went with my heart in my mouth, wondering what the hell I was going to do if he'd seen through my disguise, only to find it was the last thing my guilty conscience might have suspected.
"Makaram Khan, isn't it?" says Mason, when I stood to attention on his veranda and went through the ritual of hilt-touching. He was a tall, brisk, wiry fellow with a sharp eye which he cast over me. "Hasan Sai, Peshawar policeman, but only a few weeks' army service." He spoke good Urdu, which suggested he was smarter than most, and my innards quaked. "Well now, Makaram," says he pleasantly, "I don't believe you, nor does your own colonel. You're an old soldier. You ride like one, you stand like one, and what's more, you've held command. Now don't interrupt. No one's tried to trap you or find out how many throats you cut in the Khyber country in your time. That's nothing to me. You're here now as an ordinary sowar, but a sowar who gathers up papers as though he's as used to handling them as I am. Unusual in a Pathan, even one who's seen service, don't you agree?" "In the police, Hazur," says I woodenly, "are many kitabs and papers."
"To be sure there are," says he, and then added ever so easily in English, "What's that on your right hand?"
I didn't look, but I couldn't help my hand jerking, and he chuckled and leaned back in his chair, pleased with himself.
"I guessed you understood English when the commander and your colonel were talking in front of you yesterday," says he. "You couldn't keep it out of your eyes. Well, never mind, it's all to the good. But see here, Makaram Khan, whatever you've done, whatever you've been, what's the sense in burying yourself in the ranks of a native cavalry pultan? You've got education and experience. Why not use them? How long will it take you to make Subadar or Havildar even in your present situation? 20 years? 30? With down-country cavalry? I'll tell you what, you can do better than that." Well, it was a relief to know my disguise was safe enough, but the last thing I wanted was to be singled out in any way. However, I listened respectfully, and he went on. "I had a Pathan orderly, Ayub Jan, first-class man, with me 10 years, and now he's gone back home to inherit. I need someone else. Well, you're younger than he was, and a sight smarter, or I'm no judge. And he wasn't a common orderly, never did a menial task or anything of that order. Wouldn't have asked him to, for he was Yusofzai, and a gentleman, as I believe you are. You see?" He looked at me very steady, smiling. "So what I want is a man of affairs who is also a man of his hand, someone I can trust as a soldier, messenger, steward, aide, guide, shield on shoulder." He shrugged. "When I saw you yesterday, I thought, that's the kind of man. Well, what'd you say?"
End of side 9.